Testing, 1, 2, 3. Is it on? It's just my natural voice you hear. Testing, 1, 2. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Testing, 1, 2, 3.
Test. Now I think it's too loud. Bring it down. Testing. Testing, 1, 2, 3. Okay, it should be okay. Should be all right now. Okay, so today is April 30th,
yes.
2016. Yes.
Can you repeat the date?
Yeah, today is April 30th, 2016. Is that okay? Okay, so we will begin with the salutation to the Buddha 3 times. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Hey, good morning, everybody. Okay, so today we come to sutta number 149 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Maha Salayatanika Sutta. So this is translated as the Great Sixfold Base. And usually the title Maha, Great, is affixed to suttas which are unusually long. But this is a very short sutta, just a couple of 3 pages, but yet it's a very rich sutta, in that the contents are very compressed, but also very deep. Okay, so the sutta begins when the Buddha addresses the monks and says, I shall teach you a discourse on the Great Sixfold Base. And of course, those who have been coming regularly to the class, you know that the Sixfold Base is referring to the 6 sense bases, or the 6 internal sense faculties, eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and the mind base, the organ or faculty of thought and reflection. Okay, and so the sutta structurally it's initially it's divided into two portions. We call one is the negative portion, which deals with the state of affairs for the untrained worldly person, and then the counterpart portion deals with the same subject, but from the perspective of the trained, experienced disciple, noble disciple. Okay, so the discourse begins with the Buddha says, when one does not know and see the I as it actually is, when one does not know and see forms as they actually are, when one does not know and see I consciousness as it actually is, when one does not know and see eye contact as it actually is, when one does not know and see as it actually is the feeling pleasant, painful, or neutral that arises with eye contact as condition, then one is, here it's translated, inflamed by lust for the eye, inflamed by lust for forms, inflamed by lust for eye consciousness, for eye contact, and for the feeling felt as pleasant, painful, or neither painful nor pleasant that arises with eye contact as condition. Okay, so here we have the series of events that begins based upon the eye as the internal basis and visible forms as the external basis. Okay, so through the internal and on the basis of the eye and forms, there arises eye consciousness, which has the function of seeing forms through the eye, the meeting of consciousness with the forms through the eye is contact, and then in dependence upon contact, there arises a feeling. Okay, then it starts off when one does not know and see the eye as it actually is. And so what is being indicated or suggested by this expression, when one does not know and see? What particular factor, which is often spoken about in the Buddha's discourses? One particular mental quality or mental state?
Ignorance.
Exactly. It's referring to avidya, ignorance. Okay, then there is when one does not know and see whatever it is as it actually is, then coming down. Then we have something which is translated when one is inflamed by lust. This is a little bit, I have to say, it's a little bit of a poetic embellishment on the part of the translator. I don't remember whether Yanomoli had it like that or whether I revised it, since it goes back, 1986, 87. But the Pali word is, it's simpler, it's this one Pali word. Sa-rajati, which is just an intensification of rajati, the verb from which we get raga. Raga is what is translated lust, passion, attachment. Then the Pali sa sa rajati, I think it's probably in Sanskrit, it would probably be sanrajati. Actually, probably sanrajati. But the sun gets mutated in Pali to become the long A, sa. And so it would be, could be more simply translated, but one becomes infatuated, impassioned, attached. Okay, and then we could say, if we want to sort of transform this into a more fixed doctrinal term, what is being indicated, what doctrinal concept is being indicated by the verb sarajati? I'm thinking of something. I mean, it's correct, but there's another word that I have in mind. Right, craving or tanha. So we actually have here, in a way, it's almost like a very compressed statement of dependent origination. Here we have avijja, expressed as not knowing and not seeing, giving rise to tanha, which is expressed as becoming, in my language, or maybe Venerable Moli's language, becoming inflamed by lust. Okay, so this is how the attachment to the six sense bases arises, through not knowing and not seeing them as they really are. Then one becomes attached at a very subtle level to the internal sense bases. And then at a grosser level, usually we become attached and infatuated with the objects of the senses. Forms, sounds, odors, and so forth. And also one becomes attached especially to the feeling that arises through sensory contact. In fact, here I put avijja through tanha, but we have here other terms of dependent origination. So we have the six sense bases, contact, feeling, giving rise to craving. Okay, now the text continues. When one abides inflamed by lust, fettered, infatuated, contemplating gratification. This is a very important expression. The Pali is asada, is what I translate gratification. Literally, it means something closer to the sweet taste, the delightful taste. Okay, then the five aggregates, I would say now, the five aggregates subject to clinging are built up for oneself in the future. Okay, this is a rather subtle point. You know, it's not so obvious. So what is meant by the five aggregates that are built up for oneself in the future, it's not referring to the five aggregates that are present and visible right here and now in this life, but rather these are the five aggregates that will come into being at the beginning of the next existence. And so it is the, we say it's the ignorance working in conjunction with craving right now, attached to the six sense bases, the six sense objects, and everything else that arises. So this ignorance and craving working in conjunction are building up, you know, as long as this bodily organism lasts, then the ignorance and craving have a very secure home in which to dwell. But when this body breaks up at death, then craving doesn't have a base on which to stand. It can't stand on this physical body any longer. But because there's that ignorance and craving still present, through their engagement, involvement with the objects of the senses, they've been building up what I would call a force, a momentum, a potency, which when this body falls away, that force or momentum brings into being the next set of five aggregates, which constitutes the beginning of the next existence. And so this, according to the Buddhist teaching, this is what we call rebirth. You know, people sometimes they say that Buddhism believes in reincarnation, and then they say, is it true that you will become a chicken? You can become a chicken or a dog in your next life. In a way, it's true, but it has to be expressed more subtly, otherwise it gives rise to misunderstanding. It's not that there is a self or a soul that reincarnates from life to life and it remains the same. Now it's in this body with this identity, then it passes on to the dog or a chicken or another human being. But rather, it's certain forces in this existence, the mental forces, sort of dwelling in the stream of consciousness that propel the stream of consciousness at death into a new existence, or cause a new form of existence to arise. And that new form of existence will be constituted by the five aggregates. What are the five aggregates? Memory is getting a little... Okay, very good. So bodily form, feeling, perception, sometimes mental formations or volitional activities, and consciousness. Okay, so that is what occurs in the future. And then the text says, and one's craving, and then the next phrase is very, very important, which brings renewal of being, which brings renewed existence, which is accompanied by delight and lust and delights in this and that, or delights here and there, increases. Okay, the phrasing here is exactly what we find in the formula of the Four Noble Truths in other suttas, when the Buddha is explaining the second noble truth, the noble truth of dukkha, the noble truth of the origin or cause of dukkha. He says it's tanha pono bhavika nandi raga sahagata tatra tatrabi nandini. And you see that it says craving which brings renewal of existence. You know, I often come across people who say that we want to be realistic Buddhists, 20th century or 21st century Buddhists. We don't take this rebirth business. We are just sticking to the Four Noble Truths. But if you look at the Four Noble Truths, you look at the Second Noble Truth, it says, tanha pono bhavita. Pono bhavita is based on Puna, which means again, and bhava, existence. So puna bhava is renewed existence, repeated existence. And then when you turn this into an adjective describing something else, it becomes pono bhavika. So it's that which leads to, or which brings repeated existence. And what brings repeated existence is tanha, or craving. And then it's accompanied by delight and lust. Actually, these are two aspects of craving. So delight is the enjoyment one experiences when one gets what one wants. And then lust or desire, raga, is the desire to get what one does not have. And then this craving is described as delighting in this and that, or delighting here and there. Because the craving, it's never satisfied with what one gets. But it's always seeking delight in this and that. You know, you could see it. You don't have to be a very profound philosopher to see this, or a profound psychologist. What's the latest model of the iPhone? They're up to 6 already?
Yes.
6?
Yes.
What happened to the iPhone 4?
That's our 20th century.
And where are the iPhone 3s?
In my bills.
I think I might be one of the few people in the world that thinks back nostalgically to those days when you use a telephone to make a telephone call. And I'm still getting used to hitting the little numbered pads. I still miss the days. You know, because I went through like 20 years without almost not using a telephone at all. So I think at the time I went to Sri Lanka, we were still using the rotary phones when I come back. But people have these little, the cell phones were already out. I'm just bringing this up, of course, to illustrate the lighting in this and that. Would anybody like an iPhone 4? I think I have one. It's great, a great instrument. You can do some fantastic things.
Yes.
I still haven't figured out how to get my email online. Is Madonna still popular?
She's still here. She's still there.
I didn't think about that, right? Prince did pass away last week, though.
Yeah. I mean, I remember hearing about him, I think, or reading about him when I was in Sri Lanka in the 1980s.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
Then I don't think I heard about him since. But then when he dies, then I see on the news they're saying, oh, this brilliant, absolutely fantastic, marvelous, creative genius. But what happened during the 1990s or 2000s? I don't know. Okay, so the craving increases, and then one's bodily and mental troubles increase. One's bodily and mental torments increase. One's bodily and mental fevers. By bodily, this is really like the fever of desire, not bodily fevers like when you get the flu. And one experiences bodily and mental suffering. Okay, so this is showing, you could say, this is showing the adinava, or the danger, or the drawbacks in craving that becomes attached to, you know, to the eye and to all of the things originating through the eye. Okay, then the same pattern is repeated for the other five sense bases. Okay, now we come to the counterpart to that section. This is showing, you know, the practice of the practitioner, the one who understands the Dhamma and is practicing accordingly. And this is particularly the practitioner of insight, of vipassana. Though the commentary says that it refers to the knowledge of insight or vipassana and the noble path, that is the world transcending path. Okay, so it says, when one knows and sees the eye as it actually is, when one knows and sees forms as they actually are, when one knows and sees eye consciousness, when one knows and sees eye contact, when one knows and sees the feeling that arises with eye contact as condition, then one is not inflamed by lust, or one is not attached to the eye forms, and so forth. Okay, so when one knows and sees, this is indicating, you could say, panya, wisdom, prajna, or insight, vipassana, vidarshana. And then not becoming attached is a movement in the direction of viraga. Viraga is, we say, dispassion. It's literally the fading away of passion or lust. And so as one sees the eye and so forth as it really is, and what does it mean to see the eye and so on as it really is?
condition impermanent.
What else?
Not mine, not I.
Something else has to come.
Dukkha.
Okay, let's get it in
order.
In order.
Where's that? Ani? Wisdom?
No, I said, what does it, when one sees the eye and so forth as it really is, what is one seeing about the eye?
Eye consciousness depends on contact of form and eye faculty.
Of course, that's underlying it, but three things.
Impermanence.
Say it. Right. Anicca, dukkha, anatta. Impermanent, unsatisfactory, or suffering, and non-self. And so one is contemplating the I forms and so forth in terms of the three characteristics. And to contemplate in terms of the three characteristics, the usual way, the approach which is suitable for most people, is to begin with impermanence. Because dukkha, it's subtler, and anatta, or non-self, is the subtlest of all. And so when one is contemplating, actually, to contemplate the impermanence of the eye, it's rather difficult. But the sort of easiest access to impermanence, I would say, is through the sensations of the body. Since if one observes the body, say as one is sitting, one experiences sensations in the body, and then if one keeps on observing those sensations, one sees that they are always constantly arising and passing away. And then as the mind, the concentration becomes stronger and the attention more better sustained, then one can see the impermanence at subtler and subtler levels, till one could focus on any sensation, and one sees that that sensation is just constantly, I mean, there's no stable, persisting sensation there, but just the constant arising of new sensations. And then if one spreads the awareness globally over the body, then the body itself becomes a mass of sensations, always arising and passing. And so one sees into the impermanence of, well, first focusing on the impermanence of sensations, and then through the awareness of bodily sensation, then one could focus on the sensation of the eyes and see how the eye is constantly arising and passing away. And then to the ear. If one is sitting, actually, it's difficult to pick up the nose, tongue, and tongue. But the bodily sense. Okay, then what is impermanent is not to be taken as a basis of security. So in that sense, it is dukkha, which we translate as suffering, but it doesn't mean that all of these things are actually felt as misery, misery, pain, sorrow, but rather it means that these things are not capable of yielding secure, lasting happiness. And so they're unsatisfactory, flawed, inadequate, defective. And again, one could go directly from impermanence into non-self. That what is arising and passing away cannot be taken as self. I went through this when explaining the last sutta, sutta number 148, on the six sixes, where the Buddha argues that what arises and passes away can't be taken as this is myself. Okay, so this is seeing all of these domains of sensory experience as they actually are, that is, impermanent, dukkha, non-self. Okay, and as one is seeing them as they are, then this attachment to them begins to fade away. And so the flames of lust are starting to subside. Actually, lust is maybe not such a good word here. It's more the flames of attachment are starting to subside, or the attachment is starting to become weaker, debilitated. Okay, then when one abides uninflamed, that's such a good word choice. When one abides not attached because of lust, unfettered, uninfatuated, contemplating danger. This expression here, contemplating danger, is the opposite of the expression that we had on the other, in the other portion, contemplating gratification. So we have a distinction here between two words or two ideas. The sadha and adinava. Asada, gratification or enjoyment or sweet taste. This comes from seeing things as being pleasurable, enjoyable, taking them to be permanent, stable, identifying with them and taking them to be myself. And so one contemplates enjoyment in things, and then one goes in pursuit of them. But when one starts to see into the impermanent, empty nature of phenomena, then the danger starts to become exposed, the danger in becoming attached to them. Okay, so as one is contemplating the danger, then the five aggregates subject to clinging are diminished for oneself in the future. That is, through contemplating the danger, or contemplating things as they actually are, and seeing the danger or drawbacks in them, then that attachment that binds one to them starts to diminish. And as the attachment is diminished, then the one is sort of wearing away the five aggregates, putting a stop to the process of building up the five aggregates. Okay, and then one's craving, again, which brings renewal of being, is then abandoned. Or I would say it's in the process of being abandoned, because one is still in the stage of insight, one has not yet reached full realization. But through the contemplation of danger, when one sees the impermanence, unsatisfactory nature of things, then craving is not able to get a grip on them, because one doesn't want to grip things that are seen as being like maybe like burning coals. And so that craving starts to diminish. And then one's bodily and mental troubles are abandoned. One's bodily and mental torments are abandoned. One's bodily and mental fevers are abandoned. And one experiences bodily and mental pleasure. Okay, now we come to a new portion of the discourse, or there's a sort of transition here into it. Another section. So now the Buddha is going to relate this to the Noble Eightfold Path. And so he says, the view of a person such as this, that is one who is contemplating the real nature of the I forms and so forth. So the view of a person such as this is right view. Now I think this passage is interesting. Let me just go through the whole passage, then I'll come back to it. Okay, the view of a person like this is right view. His intention is right intention. His effort is right effort. His mindfulness is right mindfulness. His concentration is right concentration. But his bodily action, his verbal action, and his livelihood have already been well purified earlier. Okay, there are several things interesting about this. One is usually when we have the order or the exposition of the Noble Eightfold Path, what we have is the first factor. And then the second factor. And then the next factors. Right. So usually we have right view, right intention first, then right speech, right action, right livelihood. Okay, but now the Buddha is speaking about those three factors, speech, action, livelihood, as having been purified earlier. And this right view, then, is not the view that comes at the beginning of the path, which we could say is the... I would call that the conceptual understanding of the principles of the Dhamma. The one that comes at the beginning of the path, sometimes called... This is still called mundane right view even here. But it's not yet... This has gone beyond that preliminary conceptual understanding. But now this is the right view of insight knowledge. This is where one is actually doesn't have just conceptual understanding, but this is the right view where one is actually seeing into the real nature of things as being impermanent, unsatisfactory, not self. And then the intention here, you see, when we have the formal exposition of the Noble Eightfold Path, right intention is explained as the intention of renunciation or desirelessness, the intention of non-harming, the intention of non-ill will, the intention of non-harming. But other texts identify intention with the application of the mind. So here I understand that this isn't referring to right intention. Of course, there's an absence of desire, absence of ill will, absence of harming. But I don't think that's what's intended here. But rather, this is the intention as the application of the mind to the contemplation of the nature of phenomena. (Clears throat) Okay, then we have right effort. This will be the energy involved in undertaking that contemplation. And then we have the mindfulness, which is right mindfulness. And where in the four, how would we situate this right mindfulness in relation to the four foundations of mindfulness? Where would we put it? What are the four foundations of mindfulness? What's after?
Body,
yeah.
Feelings,
yeah.
Mental formations, mind and mind objects.
What? Yeah, well, she said mind objects, dhammas. Okay, so where amongst the four foundations of mindfulness will we put this mindfulness? What's called mind objects, yeah. But I think mind objects is not really such a good translation. I just would call it phenomena or dhammas. Because if you're familiar with the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the third is the contemplation of the six sense bases. So one knows the eye, one knows forms, one knows the fetter that arises dependent on both. One knows how that fetter comes into being, how that fetter is abandoned, and how there is no arising of that fetter again in the future. So this is now within the domain of dham-anupassana, contemplation of phenomena. So we could assume that this meditator has already gone through the contemplation of body, feelings, states of mind, and now is in the contemplation of phenomena. And then we come to his concentration is right concentration. This is the statement that I find most interesting, because if you know the usual definition of right concentration, it's what? Can't hear? Right, it's usually defined as the four jhanas. And so there are some people who pick up that fixed definition, right concentration, the four jhanas, and then they say, ah, that shows to practice the Noble Eightfold Path, you have to achieve the four jhanas, or at least the first jhana. But here we have right concentration as the concentration that occurs through contemplation of the six sense bases. So this is the right concentration, not as the samatha samadhi, but as the vipassana samadhi, the concentration that accompanies insight contemplation. Okay, and then it speaks about bodily action, verbal action, and livelihood have been already well purified earlier. So this is speaking about somebody who's not a beginner on the path, but somebody who has already fulfilled the components of sila, of good behavior. And so then based on good behavior, this practitioner, it seems that in the sutta there's no mention about the jhanic attainments, but has moved from good behavior, probably going through the earlier foundations of mindfulness, now into the contemplation of dhammas in terms of the six sense bases. Okay, then the text says, thus this noble eightfold path comes to fulfillment in him by development. Okay, so we have the preliminary purification of speech, action, livelihood, and now we have all the other five factors. Those are the constant factors present in the contemplative part of the path, all operative together. And so we have the Noble Eightfold Path is now coming to fulfillment by development. And then while he's developing the Noble Eightfold Path, then the four foundations of mindfulness come to fulfillment by development. The four right kinds of striving, or the four right efforts, come to fulfillment by development. Everybody knows what the four right efforts are? Okay, it's the effort to prevent the arising of unwholesome states, the effort to remove arisen unwholesome states, the effort to arouse or to awaken wholesome states, and the effort to maintain wholesome states. So those are the four right efforts. Then the four bases for spiritual power. These are the four iddhipadas. Well, that's pretty technical. Do we have any? Go on, you're doing good. Okay, you have chanda, virya.
Mind.
Okay, chitta, mind.
And wisdom.
Okay, good, good. So, chanda is desire, but this is not desire as craving, but this is the desire to make progress or desire to achieve the goal. Then energy or effort. Then citta, mind. I have to confess, this has always been rather a little bit unclear to me exactly what's meant. Maybe one day when I reach that level, then I'll know. But maybe we could say it's the purity and brightness of the mind. And then the fourth, it's actually the word that's used, is investigation, vimansa. But that's taken to be a synonym for panya, or wisdom. Then the five faculties come to fulfillment by development. What are the five faculties? Fellows, we're at almost at the end of the Majjhima Nikaya. Maybe we have to go back and go through it again. You've been answering too often.
Energy.
Okay, you can.
Mindfulness.
Yeah.
Concentration. Whisper.
Okay, good. Faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom. Those are the five spiritual faculties. Then what are the five powers? That's a tricky one. Right, it's the same as the five faculties. The same factors, but just they're being looked at from a different perspective. The five faculties, we could say that they're called faculties because indriya, because they exercise dominance in a particular role. Whereas the word bala, or power, means that these five qualities, mental qualities, are powerful, that they can't be overcome by their opposites. Okay, the list is getting longer now. This is where we separate, how was the expression go? Separate the sheep from the goats? The seven factors of enlightenment. Okay, mindfulness?
Investigation of
Let me recite. Okay, mindfulness, investigation of dhammas or of qualities?
Energy.
Energy, yeah.
Rapture.
Rapture or joy, yeah.
Tranquility.
Right, good. Okay, tranquility of mind. Excellent, yeah. Excellent. Okay, so mindfulness, investigation of qualities, energy, rapture or joy, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. Okay, then the next statement, very important. These two things, serenity and insight, occur in him yoked evenly together. According to the commentary, I have a note here from the commentary. It says that this refers to the simultaneous arising of serenity and insight in the supramundane or world-transcending path. Serenity is present under the heading of right concentration and insight under the heading of right view. Okay, that's the way it's explained from the standpoint of the commentary, which comes, you know, from a later period than the sutta. But I would say that maybe we don't have to take this in the rather narrow technical sense of the commentary. But when the practitioner is engaged even in this high stage of insight, there is both serenity, samatha, and insight, vipassana. In the way the terms are commonly used today, they speak about serenity or samatha meditation means the meditation to quiet the mind and aiming at the attainment of the jhanas. And then it's thought that insight meditation is something completely different from serenity. But it seems to me, you know, looking at looking at the early texts, without bringing in the later perspectives of the commentaries, that we could see that serenity and insight for the fulfillment of the path always have to go together. And they're not, you know, like two completely separated systems of practice. We could say that some meditation objects are more appropriate for serenity, those that are aimed at the jhanas. Other approaches of meditation go along and put more emphasis on the track of vipassana. But in order to bring the path to fulfillment, one needs some degree of both serenity and insight. And so if one takes the path or the approach of emphasizing serenity or concentration as the foundation, one has to step beyond the concentration in order to develop insight. But if one takes the track that emphasizes insight, as the insight becomes deepened, or in order for the insight to deepen, the mind has to be able to stabilize itself on the object. And so that stabilizing of the mind on the object is the precondition for the arising of insight and knowledge. And that stabilizing of the mind on the object can take place either by first developing samadhi and then using that concentrated mind, turning it in another track and contemplating the nature of phenomena. Or else, contemplating the arising and passing away of phenomena and just keeping the mind focused unshakably on the arising and passing away. And that, as the mind stabilizes on the observation of arising and passing away, that itself is the samatha, or serenity, coexisting with the contemplation of insight. In fact, in the Burmese tradition, I think stemming from Mahasi Soyodaw, maybe it was Upandita who introduced this term, vipassana jhanas, which I don't particularly like because it mixes up two discrete concepts. But it indicates that as the insight knowledges deepen, the mind is becoming concentrated at a level of concentration that corresponds to that of the jhanas. Okay, the situation that the Buddha is discussing here. He's speaking apparently about a very high stage in the practice where serenity and insight are occurring yoked evenly together. Okay, now what comes next, I would now put a paragraph, a new paragraph break here. Because this, what comes next, I would say, is indicating the world transcending or supermundane level of realization. So now it says, he fully understands by direct knowledge those things that should be fully understood by direct knowledge. He abandons by direct knowledge those things that should be abandoned by direct knowledge. He develops by direct knowledge those things that should be developed by direct knowledge. He realizes by direct knowledge those things that should be realized by direct knowledge. This statement, if you're familiar with the full first discourse of the Buddha, the turning of the wheel of the Dharma, you know, in the first discourse, the Buddha doesn't just explain the Four Noble Truths. That's only the first part or second part of the sutta. But in the next part, he speaks about the functions or tasks that correspond to each of the Four Noble Truths. So he says that the noble truth of suffering should be fully understood. The noble truth of the origin of suffering should be abandoned. The noble truth of the cessation of suffering should be realized. And the noble truth of the way to the cessation of suffering should be developed or cultivated. And so here, this statement is in a way echoing or mirroring that particular passage in the Buddha's first sermon. Okay, and now, after making that brief statement, now he's going to fill in and explain what are these things that towards which one should exercise each of these four functions. So now we're in paragraph 11. He says, what things should be fully understood by direct knowledge? And let me give the Pali here. Okay, so the full what's called translated full understanding, it comes from the prefix pari, which gives a sense of fullness. Then jnaya is from the verbal root jna, which means to know. So we get the verb janati, one knows. And here, this is called future passive participle. And so what are the things to be fully understood by direct knowledge? And so the answer to that is the five aggregates which are bound up with clinging, subject to clinging. Then he just enumerates them. The material form, physical form aggregate, the feeling aggregate, the perception aggregate, the mental formations, or this is sankhara khanda, the volitional activities, and the consciousness aggregate. Okay, what are the things that should be abandoned by direct knowledge? In the second noble truth, the Buddha keeps it simple, and he just says craving, tanha. But here, I think because he's going to a deeper level, so he says what should be abandoned by direct knowledge is our ignorance and craving for existence, the craving for repeated existence. And then what are the things that should be developed by direct knowledge? In the first sermon, the Buddha says it's the Noble Eightfold Path that should be developed. But here, because the Buddha is apparently speaking to advanced practitioners, so they don't need the earlier stages of the path, so he just says serenity and insight. And then what are the things that should be realized by direct knowledge? So that is, here it's given true knowledge. Is there any such thing as false knowledge? Well, if it's false knowledge, then it's not knowledge, but misunderstanding.
So it could be false knowledge. There's people that have an idea, they think it's, I mean, they're knowledgeable to some people.
Yeah, I would call that misunderstanding, or the conceit of knowledge. But this is the simple Pali word, is vijja. So we have true knowledge. Now I would prefer to use maybe clear knowledge or complete knowledge. Vijja. So this would be the full and clear knowledge of the Four Noble Truths. And then deliverance. This is in Pali, it's vimukti, which I would prefer now to render liberation. I think because this came from Venerable Nyanamoli and they were still under the influence of the British translators of the early 20th century, who had a little bit of the flavor of biblical terminology. Okay, so clear knowledge and liberation. These are the things that should be realized by direct knowledge. Okay, then the rest of the sutta actually just simply takes this whole course of development, starting from paragraph 9 through 11, and then it applies it to the other five sense modalities. So unless you don't know what the other sense modalities are, there's no need to develop it in full. I think what we have to remember, probably the early generations of monks who learned the discourse, you have to remember the discourses were not written down for 400 years, 300, 400 years. And so they were transmitted orally and had to be memorized. And so in order to imprint the text on the memory bank, the reciters would certainly have recited each passage in full. But now with the invention of the printing press, we've gotten lazy. But if you want to really develop your mindfulness, you could recite the whole thing going through each sense base. Okay, maybe we have some time for questions now. Ravi, did you have your hand up? Anyway, you could speak loudly. Just speak loudly. I'll repeat the question.
Ignorance and craving.
Yeah.
It is the cause of rebirth. Is it okay if we say karmic energy caused by ignorance and craving is the one that results in the rebirth?
I'm okay.
Karma pala. Like karma pala. Ignorance and craving.
Yeah.
Results in a karmic energy, a karmic force that continues as a form of...
Of course the karma continues, but the karma itself is not the driving force, because everybody has accumulated karma, even the arhat has accumulated karma. But the arhat eliminates craving and ignorance, and so then the karmic energy, whatever remains, the karmic energy that's due to ripen in that life will continue to ripen. But with the passing away, because ignorance and craving are eliminated, then there's no further opportunity for the karma to ripen.
Yeah, for me, it's easy to understand an energy going from life to life.
Oh, I see, I see.
Ignorance and craving are two different things.
I would say what goes from life to life is the stream of consciousness. And the karmic energy, you could say, is embedded within that stream of consciousness.
The stream of consciousness, that force you were saying that then will continue on to the new life, does that force create the new life that it's going to attach to? Or is there something that is already conceived that it's going to be drawn to? You know, if I'm being clear. Like, is the force creating this new form itself? Or is there a form that's kind of like,
in the case of human life, it needs the physical basis to attach to. It's not that the stream of consciousness can create in embryo, you know, just out of thin air. It needs a fertilized ovum to connect to.
So that has to be, the conception has to occur, I think I'm talking loud enough, right? So the conception is there and then it attaches to it. Now, in another existence, not human.
Yeah.
Or animal, I guess, would be the same kind of thing.
In the case of animals, it would be the same as human.
Yeah.
At least the mammals, it would be the same.
In other realms, is it the same kind of thing? Or it doesn't really...
I understand what you mean. In the case of certain other realms of existence, like the heavenly realms, probably the hell realms, the stream of consciousness will appear spontaneously. It doesn't depend upon, you know, the foundation of like a fertilized egg, because rebirth in those realms is said to be spontaneous.
And does the, when I'm just trying to get a vision, I know I'm very concrete, like I'm a visual person trying to get a visual. So if a the, if there's a conceived, I guess, well, you were saying at one point that three things have to occur for conception. The stream has to attach, the new consciousness yeah. has to occur, so that baby won't come to being without that new consciousness. So does it have to be something that's close by? Or, like, is it, like, can a person die here and then their new consciousness goes to India?
Of course, this is something I don't have first-hand experience. But I understand the question. There have been some people who have done research on these cases of children who, when they're able to start speaking, can identify their past life. Usually, but in these cases, it's usually what has happened is that the person in the past life died prematurely, usually in an accident. And in those cases, the person in the previous life was living pretty close to the place where the person has taken the rebirth. My supposition is, yeah, I don't know. But I would think that because one would tend to have affinities or connections with people living close by, one would tend to take rebirth fairly close by. But it's not like an invariable or fixed law that if there are conditions, one might take rebirth elsewhere.
Thank you. The story about the American kid who was a pilot in the firebird or whatever,
yeah.
that took place in Japan, right? And then he was supposed to be born in America.
Yeah.
So it could be possible.
Yeah, I think. Do you have the mic, Chris?
Yes. So that stream of consciousness is the Bhavanga, right?
This gets into rather technical areas. Okay, let's just, to keep it simple, we'll say that's the Bhavanga. But the Bhavanga is an Abhidhammic term. Like in the Sutta, one doesn't find the word Bhavanga, but there's an expression in some suttas, Vijnana Sota, which actually means Sota is a stream and Vijnana is consciousness. So it has the expression stream of consciousness. Okay, Alvina and Kim. No, that seems to be.
It's not like when you mentioned spontaneous. That spontaneous is going to the other realms.
Yeah.
But for this realm,
yeah.
The stream of consciousness is very aware to know the experience it needs for it to continue. It's not that we get born as an animal. It doesn't happen, it's not as random as that. It's not that I would go into just about any place in my next lifetime and start my whole stream of consciousness experience all over again. I don't know where I'm getting this wrong, but I don't think it's as random as that. I don't think it's as random as that.
Yeah, the idea that one chooses one's parents or one chooses one's next life. That seems to be like, I would call it a popular misconception. There's no choice involved. But I would say that there's maybe what's involved is a karmic affinity, a karmic connection, or a karmic connection of some kind. And it's not that the process of rebirth is a kind of educational institution in which we are learning lessons from one life to the next. Of course we can, but not necessarily. So what I would say is the karmic, or the process of rebirth, it's maintained by the karmic connections, karmic affinities, but not by conscious choice.
Born
what?
I won't say are born more aware, but some people have a different level of consciousness than some other creatures would. I mean, that's a given thing. I mean, I would question the consciousness of a, you know, say, a pet dog.
Of a what?
I wouldn't question the consciousness of a pet dog versus a wild animal versus myself. But there is a different level of consciousness available at different levels. So
I mean, there are, of course, there are very vast gradations of consciousness among human, between living beings of different types. I mean, ranging from, you know, the consciousness of a mosquito to other insects, frogs, all the ways to the consciousness of, you know, highly spiritually accomplished human beings. And even amongst human beings, there's vast differences in the capacities, potentials of consciousness. But that has nothing to do with the idea of people choosing their parents or mode of rebirth. It's just that when one passes from one life to the next, it's not that all one's past experiences and past capacities are just wiped out and one starts with a blank slate. But when one goes from one life to the next, one brings along the different karmic energies one's accumulated, as well as the different degrees of maturity of the spiritual faculties, customs, habits, interests, inclinations. All of this is carried along from one life to the next.
But you don't believe that there is any order to where a person is born or what their next life is based on your current life?
Based on?
On your current life.
There is an order based on the current life. It's just what I'm saying is that it's not the case that one consciously chooses the next form of existence. It occurs, you would say, through the unfolding or operation of a natural law. Again, I'd illustrate this a little grossly, but a little inaccurately. If I throw a rubber ball against that wall at a particular angle, it will deflect off that wall, bounce off that wall at a particular angle. You know, determined by the laws of physics. So its motion is not random, but the ball doesn't consciously choose to move off in that direction. But because I throw it with a certain force at a certain angle, it will deflect at a corresponding angle.
And there's a question from the internet. It's about a Tibetan Bodhisattva who claimed they can reach a stage they can choose where and when they and what type of rebirth.
Perhaps this may be the case. I mean, again, it's something that lies beyond my capacity to say. And there are, I mean, this is within the Tibetan system. But then I don't even know in the case of, say, like the Dalai Lama, whether he actually, you know, from his previous, the 13th Dalai Lama, whether he actually consciously chooses where he's to be reborn. But it seems he has some foreknowledge of where he'll be reborn. Because I think he left, and some of these highly advanced lamas, they leave certain indications to their disciples of where to look for their new incarnation. But that doesn't imply necessarily that they take their next rebirth through a conscious choice. It's just that they might foresee where they're going to be reborn.
Thank you.
conscious choice. Can you talk about how much of an influence death consciousness has on...
Okay. How much of an influence death consciousness has on the next rebirth?
Yes.
Okay, this is somewhat of a big topic. But just to deal with it concisely. Okay, first in abhidhamic terms, what is called death consciousness is the very last moment of consciousness at the very end of the life. And that last final death consciousness has no influence at all on the next life. That death consciousness, I call this the sign-off of the end of this life. And I compare it to at the end of a movie where, you know, the words come up, the end. You know, the words, the end, the screen that says the end, it's not part of the movie, not part of the story. Okay, what has the influence on the next life is not the final death consciousness, but the final death, the final process before death, which precedes the actual death consciousness. You see, there's the final process, and that is a karmically active type of consciousness. And when that is finished, then comes the death consciousness, which just says over. Okay, so that death, that final process, generates the rebirth into the next existence. But the final death process generally will repeat a karma which has been habitually performed through one's life. So it's a kind of echoes a habitual karma in the course of this life, or else it will echo some exceptional, very powerful karma, either good or bad, that was done in the course of that life. So it's not, you know, so easy to think, okay, I'll take it
right.
Take
right.
It easy out on the town.
All right, I'll learn to meditate and then I'll go live a life of complete luxury.
So I'll live it up now. And then when I enter into the death process, then I'll be really virtuous.
Okay, I just have a short question. Mindfulness is one of the mental factors.
Yeah.
So in this sense, could it also belong to the third foundation of mindfulness, which is the foundation of mindfulness of the mind? The third foundation of mindfulness, would that belong there also?
In relation to what?
With all foundations of mindfulness.
Yeah.
Would mindfulness also be
of course, one? Of course, mindfulness of the mind is the third foundation of mindfulness. Okay. But the point I was making during the class was simply that, or the point was that in the passage which is speaking about knowing and seeing the eye, ear, nose, tongue, and so forth, this corresponds to the fourth foundation of mindfulness, because one of the sets within the fourth foundation of mindfulness is contemplation of the six sense bases. Okay, I think we'll have to end for the day. I know I said we would take two suttas today, thinking this is short, just 1, 2, 3 pages. But the sutta that comes after is really very simple. So you could just read it. I don't think it needs discussion. You know, I was just going to go through this sutta and then leave like 10 minutes just almost to read sutta number 150. But if you're not so lazy, you can read it on your own. Okay, so we'll end with the sharing of the merits. And then we have the class next week. That's May 7th. And next week, Shall I aim to take Sutta 151 and 52? Well, what I could do, I could say, like I said last week, we'll aim to take 151 and 152. If we don't complete it, then we'll do 151 and then 152 the following week. Okay, so let us share the merits. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahidika punyanta nanomodipa chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahidika punyanta nanomodipa chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata chabhumata deva naga mahidika punyanta nanumoditva chiram rakantu mam param. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabbasampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabbasampati siddhya. Etavatacham hehi sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sadanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagopadaya avici hetato etantare satakayupapana rupiya rupicha sanya sanino dukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin.
You
went faster, yeah? Yeah, I know about that. Yeah, so after class, we'll have a short discussion, question and answer. And I have a little special task. I'd like a few people to stay for that. Not to clean up Taishu Hall, but to put labels on our Buddhist Global Relief brochures. So if we can get some team of volunteers, that can go much more quickly. I think Sandy has been doing it all alone. Well, with her husband helping, and it goes rather slowly, but if we can get like 10 or 20 people, or 20 people, it'll be a cinch. Okay, so let us end with three half hours to the Buddha.
I don't need you to stay in the situation.